Harry Coyne called out,
Hagbard, there's a couple of guys up the road flagging us down.
Hagbard turned and peered ahead.
Right. They're crew members from the Leif Erikson. Pull up where they tell you to, Harry.
He reached up to a silver vase mounted behind the back seat and took a pink rosebud out of the fresh bouquet he had placed there that morning. He carefully inserted the rosebud in the buttonhole of his lapel. The great golden Bugatti rolled to a stop, and the four men got out. Harry patted its long front fender with a long, skinny hand.
Thanks for letting me drive this car, Hagbard,
he said.
That's the nicest thing anybody's ever done for me.
No, it isn't. Now you want your own Bugatti, or what's worse, you'll ask me to let you be my chauffeur.
No, I won't, but I'll do a deal with you. You let me have this car, and whenever you want to go somewhere in it, I'll drive you.
Hagbard laughed and slapped Coyne on the back.
You keep on showing that much intelligence, and you will end up owning one.
The long line of cars that had been following the Bugatti were now stopping along the edge of the road behind it. There was a stretch of lawn that sloped gently down from the road to the lake. Out on the choppy blue water, a round gold buoy drifted, giving off a cloud of red smoke. Stella stepped out of the Mercedes 600 that was parked behind the Bugatti. George half expected Mavis and Miss Mao to get out with her, but there was no sign of them. He looked at her and was unable to speak. He didn't know what to say. She looked back at him with grave, sad eyes in silence.
Somehow,
he thought,
it will all be different and better when we get down to the submarine. In the submarine, we'll be able to talk to each other.
A pink Cadillac behind the Mercedes disgorged Simon Moon and Clark Kent. Stella did not turn to look at them. They were talking excitedly to each other. A motorcycle pulled up behind the Cadillac. Otto Waterhouse climbed off it. Now Stella turned and looked at Otto, then back to George. Otto looked at Stella, then at George. Stella suddenly turned away from both of them and walked down to the edge of the lake. A large inflated life raft was pulled up on shore, and one of Hagbard's men, sitting in the raft, stood up holding a wetsuit as Stella approached. Slowly, as if she were all alone by the shore of the lake, Stella took off her peasant blouse and skirt and continued stripping until she was naked. Then she started to put on the wetsuit. Meanwhile, another man got behind the wheel of Hagbard's Bugatti Royale and drove it across the lawn. Two other men held the mouth of a huge transparent plastic bag far enough apart so that the car could be driven right into it. They tied up the end of the bag with strong wire. Ropes attached to the bag grew taut, their other ends disappeared into the water. Slowly, looking somewhat majestic and somewhat ridiculous, the car slid across the lawn and into the water. When it had been pulled out a short distance from shore, it began to float. Out of the deeper water popped two golden scuba launches, Hagbard's men in black wetsuits mounted in the saddles. The launches positioned themselves on either side of the automobile in its plastic bubble, and the men lashed the launches and the car together with cables. Then they started their engines and launches. Men and car quickly sank out of sight. Meanwhile, more rubber rafts pulled ashore, and all of Hagbard's people started donning wetsuits distributed by the men from the submarine.
I've never done this before,
said Lady Velcor.
Are you sure it's safe?
Don't worry, baby,
said Simon Moon.
Even a man could do it.
Where's your friend Mary Lou?
George asked.
She left me,
Simon said glumly.
The damned acid fucked up her mind.
No, because in the long run, whites and blacks and men and women have to come to an understanding and an equality. No. Because this split can't go on forever. I mean, shit. I understand that. But no, I can't. Not now. No, I am not ready yet. The penis I imagined I had last night was not just some Freudian hallucination. There's the phallic power behind the physical penis. No, the acting from the center of the body, what Simon says Hagbard calls acting from the heart, and only a few can have that right now? No. Most of us haven't learned and haven't been given a chance to learn. That's the real castration. The real impotence in both men and women. In both blacks and whites. No, the power that we think is phallic because this is a patriarchal society. No, I can't be Simon's woman or anybody's woman. First, I've got to be my own woman. And it may take years. It may take life. I may never achieve it. But I've got to try. I can't end up like Daddy. I can end up like most blacks, and most of the whites, too, end up. No, maybe I'll meet Simon again. Maybe we can try a second time. That acid nut Timothy Leary always said, you can be anything you want the second time around. No, it can't be this time. It's got to be the second time around. No, I said no. I won't. No.
I hope the hell Hauptmann was telling the truth about not following me,
said Hagbard.
It's going to take time to get us all down below.
What are we doing with the cars?
Harry Coyne asked.
Well, the Bugatti obviously is too beautiful for me to part with, which is why I'm taking it aboard the Leif Erikson. But the rest will just leave. Maybe some of the people who went to the festival will be able to use them.
Don't worry about them, Huns,
said John Dillinger, strolling up.
Any of them give us trouble, we'll just reply with a few short, sharp words from old Mr. Thompson. Leave 'em in stitches.
Peace. It's wonderful,
said Hagbard sourly.
Give it a chance,
said Malaclips, still in the guise of Jean-Paul Sartre.
It needs time to spread. The absence of the Illuminati has to make itself felt. It will make a difference.
I doubt it,
said Hagbard.
The Dalai Lama was right all along.
The entire operation of outfitting Hagbard's people with wetsuits, paddling them out to the scuba launches, and transporting them down to the Leif Erikson took more than an hour. When it was George's turn, he looked eagerly into the depths for the Leif Erikson, and was happy when he saw it glowing below him like a great golden blimp.
Well, at least that's real,
he thought.
I'm approaching it from the outside, and it's just as big as I think it is. Even if it doesn't go anywhere, and this is all happening in Disney World.
An hour later, the submarine was deep in the Sea of Volusia. George, Joe, and Hagbard stood on the bridge, Hagbard leaning against the ancient Viking prow, George and Joe peering into the endless gray depths, watching the strange blind fishes and monsters swim by.
There's a type of fungus that has evolved into something resembling seaweed in this ocean,
said Hagbard.
It's luminescent. There's no light down here, so no green plants grow.
A dot appeared in the distance and grew rapidly in size until George recognized a porpoise, doubtless Howard. There was scuba diving equipment strapped to the animal's back. When he had come alongside, he turned a somersault, and his translated voice started to come through the loudspeaker in a song.
When he swims, the oceans spill. He can start earthquakes at will. He lived when the earth was desolate. I sing Leviathan the Great.
Hagbard shook his head.
That doggerel is just awful. Going to have to do something about fuck-up's ability to translate poetry. What are you talking about, Howard?
Aha,
said Joe.
I didn't get a look at your talking porpoise friend last time I was aboard. Hello, Howard. I'm Joe.
Hello, Joe,
said Howard.
Welcome to my world. Unfortunately, it is not a very hospitable world at the moment. There is grave danger in the Atlantic. The true ruler of the Illuminati is on the prowl on the high seas. Leviathan himself. The land is collapsing beside the Pacific, and the tremors have made the earth shake, and Leviathan is disturbed and has risen from the depths. Besides the trembling of the land and seas, he knows that his chief worshippers, the Illuminati, are dead. He had read their passing in the pulsings of consciousness energy that reach even into the depths of the sea.
Well, he can't eat the submarine,
said Hagbard.
And we're well armed.
He can crack the submarine open as easily as a gull cracks a penguin's egg,
said Howard.
And your weapons will bother him not at all. He's virtually indestructible.
Hagbard shrugged, while Joe and George looked askance at each other.
I'll be careful, Howard, but we can't turn around now. We've got to get back to North America. We'll try to evade Leviathan if we see him.
He fills the whole ocean,
said Howard.
No matter what you do, you'll see him, and he'll see you.
You're exaggerating.
Only slightly. I must bid you farewell now. I think we've done a good week's work, and the menace to my people recedes, even as does the danger to yours. Our porpoise horde is scattering and leaving by different exits into the North Atlantic. I'm getting out of the Sea of Illusia by way of Scotland. We think Leviathan will head south around Cape Horn into the Pacific. Everything that swims and is hungry is going that way. There's a lot of fresh meat in the water, I'm sorry to say. Goodbye, friends!
So long, Howard,
said Hagbard.
That was a good bridge you helped me build.
Yes, it was,
said Howard.
Too bad you had to sink it.
What were those tanks on Howard's back?
Said Joe.
Scuba gear, said George. There's no air available in the Sea of Illusia, so Howard has to have breathing equipment till he can get to the open ocean. Hagbard, what was that business about the true ruler of the Illuminati? I've heard again and again that there were 5 Illuminati primi. 4 of them were the Sauer family. That leaves 1. Is it Leviathan? Is the whole show being run by a sea monster? Is that the big secret?
No,
said Hagbard.
You have yet to figure out who the 5th Illuminatus Primus is.
He threw Joe a wink that George missed.
By true ruler, Howard meant a godlike being whom the Illuminati worship.
A sea monster?
Said Joe.
There was a hint about a sea monster of enormous size and power in that movie that those people showed me in that loft on the Lower East Side. But the original Illuminati, Gruad's bunch, were portrayed as sun worshippers. That big pyramid with the eye in it was supposed to be the sun god's eye. Who the hell were those people with the movie anyway? I know who Miss Mao is now, but I still don't know who they were.
Members of the Arisian Liberation Front, Elf,
said Hagbard.
They have a somewhat different view of the prehistory and origins of the Illuminati than we do. One thing we both agree upon is that the Illuminati invented religion.
The original sin, right?
Said Joe sardonically.
Joe, you ought to start a religion yourself,
said Hagbard.
Why?
Because you are so skeptical.
We're going back to America, huh?
Said George.
And the adventure is more or less over?
This phase of it, at least,
said Hagbard.
Good. I want to try to write about what I've seen and what has happened to me. I'll see you guys later.
There's to be a magnificent dinner tonight in the main dining salon,
said Hagbard. Joe said,
don't forget, confrontation has a first option on anything you write.
Fuck you.
George's voice came back as the door of the bridge closed behind him.
Wish I had something better to do than this. Gimme 2,
said Otto Waterhouse.
You do, don't you?
Said Harry Coyne.
Ain't that Negra gal, Stella, your gal? Why ain't you with her?
Because she doesn't exist,
said Otto, picking up the 2 cards John Dillinger had slid across the polished teak wood table to him. He studied his hand for a moment, then threw a 5-ton flax note into the pot.
Any more than Mavis or Miss Mao exists. There's a woman somewhere under all those identities, but everything I've experienced has been a hallucination.
There isn't a woman in the world you couldn't say that about,
said Dillinger.
How many cards you want, Harry?
3,
said Harry.
This is a lousy hand you dealt me, John. Come to think of it, you're hallucinating all the time when you have sex. That's what makes it good, and that's how come I can fuck anything.
I'll just take 1,
said Dillinger.
Dealt myself a pretty good hand. What do you see when you're fucking trees and little boys and whatnot, Harry?
A white light,
said Harry.
Just a big, beautiful, clear white light. I'll throw in 10 tons of flax this time.
Must be your hand isn't so lousy after all,
said Waterhouse.
Come in,
said George. The stateroom door opened and he put down his pen. It was Stella.
We have a little problem, don't we, George?
She said, coming into the room and sitting beside him on the bed.
I think you're angry at me,
she went on, putting her hand on his knee.
You feel like this identity of mine is a sham, so in a sense, I was deceiving you.
I've lost you and Mavis both,
said George.
You're both the same person, which means you're really neither. You're immortal. You're not human, and I don't know what you are.
Suddenly, he looked at her hopefully.
Unless that was all a hallucination last night. Could it have been the acid? Can you really change into different people?
Yes,
said Mavis.
Don't do that,
said George.
It upsets me too much.
He darted a little glance to his side. It was Stella.
I don't really understand why it bothers me so much,
said George.
I ought to be able to take everything in stride by now.
Did it ever bother you that you were in love with Mavis besides being in love with me?
Said Stella.
Not much, because it hardly ever seemed to bother you. But I know why now. How could you be jealous when you and Mavis were the same person?
We're not the same person, really.
What does that mean?
Did you ever read The Three Faces of Eve? Listen.